before we start, I just wanted to make clear for the record that we did ask both parties whether they thought it was necessary to have this argument in a closed courtroom. Both sides apparently are comfortable with the fact that we won't be having it in a closed courtroom. But if we, if court asks a question that the government, I guess it's more aimed at the government, that the government thinks calls for SSI material, they should let us know. Okay.
Thank you very much for this opportunity to be here today. TSA issued a final order on September 20th, 2011, which determined that four posts by Mr. Laxon on a public internet site constituted sensitive security information, we'll call it SSI. And the only basis cited in the order itself was that, quote, experts reviewed the posts, end quote, and as a result, the author of the order concluded that the posts constituted SSI.
Can I just ask you whether, assuming that the Mr. Laxon's explanation assuming it's legitimate to reject that, do you question the judgment in other words, if it was true that it was SSI?
No, if it was true that it's SSI and it was actually...
No, if the data uttered were true, it was SSI.
If the posts were true, it is SSI.
Okay, good.
Yes. Mr. Laxon's claim from the inception has been, I made it up.
Right.
Okay. So the only basis for the TSA's conclusion that it's SSI was that its experts reviewed the posts and they concluded it's SSI. And we know that this court, this panel, can set aside that order if the order itself is unsupported by substantial evidence or is otherwise arbitrary and capricious. The definition of SSI that was invoked by the TSA is at the 49 CFR section 1520 and it's subsection B8 Roman numeral 2, and the material portion of that regulation states that sensitive security information specific details of security measures applied directly by TSA, which includes but is not limited to various categories. And TSA consistently seems to ignore the relevance of that phrase, applied directly by TSA, which means that information needs to be somehow within that stream of operation that if we look at the general language, at subsection A, 1520.5A, SSI is information obtained or developed in the conduct of security. If it's information that's obtained or developed or applied, it means the information has to be true. It has to exist. It has to be of use, has to be of value.
So, can I just ask, just wonder whether this is even an issue. The TSA order here says that this was true. This was SSI information. Now, they may be wrong about that, in which case you'll win.
I understand.
I appreciate the government in its briefs has some argument that maybe if it wasn't true, still could be SSI, but that wasn't the basis of the order, was it?
No.
You don't think the order isn't saying we don't care whether it's true or not, it's still SSI?
That's correct. It does not say
that. It does not say that. Okay.
It does not say that. And I don't understand TSA to take the position that if it is fictitious, that it's true. We know that...
So then Judge Williams has got exactly the right point, which is the only issue here is whether there's substantial evidence that it was true.
I would agree, Your Honor.
Okay.
And so if we look at the record in this case, and we see, well, what is the evidence that's been cited by the agency to suggest that it's true with respect to these four posts? At the end of the day, all that we have are double hearsay statements. We have Mr. Laxon's signed sworn statement. I made it up. It's fictitious. I'm sorry. I express my remorse. Whatever his issues are, it's false.
What do you say about the Honeywell case in this circuit, in which we said that two sets of hearsay were sufficient for substantial evidence, one of which this had to do with the question of whether the EPA could find that a fishery existed in an area, a particular area of the river. And then in our opinion, we described the two pieces of evidence upon which the conclusion was based. The first was that the contractor performing the evaluation spoke with a biologist who said the river is fished. Isn't that very similar to what we have here? And second, the contractor spoke with a man who worked at the site as a representative of Superfund, who reported that he observed people fishing. Why isn't that the same as this?
Because the independent contractor in that case spoke to, had firsthand knowledge.
Well, he didn't have firsthand knowledge. He spoke to somebody, right? It says he spoke to those people.
Well, I believe the court also pointed out that he informed the agency officials that he had personally observed individuals fishing in the area of the Hudson River close to where the pollutants were disgorged. And he did observe certain types of fish in the fishery area available for human consumption. So the court also examined, as I read the decision, certain contemporaneous records of the contractor, and which memorializes observations of the area. So it wasn't merely based on hearsay. He had personal observation of people fishing for human consumption proximate to where the pollutants were being disgorged. That's how I read the Honeywell case. And here, we have no corroboration of the hearsay statements. All we have are these double hearsay statements from a Mr. Jeffries and a Mr. Bauer, who state, Mr. Jeffries says, simply, two of the posts are, quote, factually true, and that's at the appendix, petitioner's appendix 15. That's all we have. He says, well, they're factually true. He says that to Mr. Bolton, and Mr. Bolton says that to Mr. Benner, and Mr. Benner sends it to Mr. Metzler. Mr. Bauer says, and that's with respect to, Jeffries is with respect to posts 2282 and an undated post. And Mr. Bauer says, well, part of post 3194 is confirmed as true. And that's all we have, nothing else. We don't have a sworn statement from those individuals. We don't have, this is not a routine type of report that they proffered. We have, could they have provided a sworn statement? Yes, they're in control of the agency. Could they have rationalized their conclusions and say, look, just like that contractor in Honeywell, I looked at the records, and quite frankly, the records show that these are true. If they had merely said that, they may have met the substantial evidence threshold, but they didn't even say that they looked at any records, or they inspected any documents, or they spoke to any third parties. We don't have any indicia of reliability in this record that those posts are true.
Do you have a pin site for the what you just described about the contractor doing his own investigation? I'm not saying it's not here. I just can't immediately find it. Do you have a page?
Well, I looked at page 447 of Honeywell.
Those are that's the page I was referring to.
Declarant.
Yes, the declarant relied upon. He was the declarant, and he's the one. At the court noted that he did personally observe individuals fishing in proximate location to the pollutants.
It's not the contractor who observed the people fishing. It's the Mr. Quinones who the contractor spoke to. It's the hearsay person. It's a person whose statement was hearsay. It's not anybody who's directly saying anything.
Well, even accepting that, at least we have a witness who examined the location and reports what he saw. We don't have anything like that here. We don't have any effort on the part of these agency experts to examine any records. How is this panel to gain some assurance of the reliability of these conclusory hearsay statements? There isn't anything here.
Could I ask you, the other members of the panel don't have a question on this exact issue, back on the jurisdiction issue that we asked both sides to brief. So how is this case different than the Elgin case where the court said that you could not attack the constitutionality of the provision upon which the person was terminated, that before circuit court had to be before MSPB to begin with, and the Fausto case where the court said that even though the Back Pay Act might have once provided a source of review, the CSRA overrides it. Why aren't those cases controlling here?
Well, those cases addressed adverse actions and relations between the trust relations between an employer and employee. The Civil Service Reform Act, which was interpreted by Fausto, preempted all the jurisdictions of all the courts concerning anything to do with the tenure of an employee or any adverse action.
That's what we have here. We have an adverse action in the end against an employee.
Well, the difference is that here the only issue is whether the posts constitute SSI. It has nothing to do with adverse action. I know that the agency will say, well, gee, Mr. Laxon, you were acting in a very unbecoming way in boasting and sitting and writing all these things, but that's not what's before this court. That is before the Merit Systems Protection Board and ultimately the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals. Here, the only issue is narrow, and that is this sensitive security information or not?
Well, in Fausto, wasn't the only question whether, let's see if I have the case correct, whether a statute barring from employment people who had not registered, is that the right? Have I got the, or is that Elgin? Yeah, no, I'm sorry. In Elgin, the issue was only the constitutionality of the provision of the Military Selective Service Act, which required registration and barred from employment people who failed to register. The specific question of whether this person had failed to register or whether he could be barred from employment would go to the MSPB, but the pure legal question of the constitutionality would have gone before another court, and the Supreme Court said that's too bad. It still all has to go before the MSPB. Isn't that right?
It did.
And why is that? So why is this different?
Well, I'm not challenging the regulations on any constitutional grounds. And secondly, the Congress has granted this court, as I interpret the plain language of the statute, exclusive jurisdiction to review this TSA order. Fausto doesn't preempt. Fausto doesn't purport to preempt this court from that type of review.
It's well, in 28 U.S.C. 1331, Congress gave this court and the other district court and the district courts jurisdiction over constitutional challenges to statutes. And that and nonetheless, in Fausto, the court said that wasn't good enough.
I understand. But I don't, well, this statute is very specific. And certainly Congress can decide on its own which courts it decides to give review authority to. And it gave explicit review authority to this court. I'm not arguing the constitutionality of this statute, or I'm arguing that this order, which is reviewable by this court, simply was issued in an arbitrary and capricious way. But Fausto does not preempt in any way. Well, the Civil Service Reform Act doesn't preempt in any way a challenge here.
Okay. Any questions from the panel? Right, you maybe want to reserve your
yeah, sure.
minutes?
Sure.
Hear from the government?
May it please the court, Edward Himmelfarb for TSA and the Department of Homeland Security. Congress directed TSA to issue regulations that would protect sensitive information from disclosure if the disclosure of that information would be detrimental to the security of transportation. And TSA, in fact, has issued those regulations. Those are the regulations that we're discussing here today to protect sensitive security information from disclosure if disclosure would have a detrimental effect on the security of transportation. Now, there's an obvious reason for doing this, that the mission of the Federal Air Marshals is to protect flights from threats of potential terrorists.
Can we start with the jurisdictional question?
Sure.
So you heard the question I asked opposing counsel. So how does this come within Elgin? Why doesn't this come within Elgin?
Well, I think we start with 46110A, and you look, and one of the statutes it specifically refers to is 49 U.S.C. 114S, I believe it is, which has subsequently been renumbered 114. So we are talking about, the Congress was talking about orders that were issued for precisely this purpose.
How do we know that this is an order really issued precisely to decide whether a particular individual has violated the regulation? It's not an order establishing a regulation. It's not an order deciding what SSI is. It's an order deciding whether four statements made by an individual were SSI.
That's correct.
Well, how do we know that that's what, I mean, that, if we wanted to give full force to the Supreme Court's view that the CSRA really should govern termination questions and that we not have sort of parallel proceedings, wouldn't the way to do that be to narrow the 46110 to orders that truly are about establishing something as SSI?
Well, I think that would be a narrowing of the actual text of the statute, and I don't think that's justified here. Remember, there is an MSPB proceeding that will go on.
The statute says an order with respect to security duties and powers. So what if the TSA said, in order to handle our security duties and powers, we're firing this guy because he, and all in one proceeding, we're firing this guy because he violated SSI, because he disclosed SSI. Would that be an order?
No, because Congress has also said that employment sanctions, employment actions, personnel actions are done through the FAA and CSRA.
So why isn't this pretty much the same thing?
All this does is it declares one point, which is that these statements were SSI under the regulation. The MSPB, and this, you know, if you go back to the McLean case, that case actually parallels this very much. There's an MSPB action. They paused to get judicial review of the order analogous to this order in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And then they went back to the MSPB.
But the issue wasn't discussed. The issue we're talking about here, which is the possibility that Fausto governs, wasn't discussed at all, right?
I don't believe it was, Your Honor, but when the case went back to the MSPB, the MSPB itself at the board level, not at the AJ level, the board decided that that procedure was proper. It did not have jurisdiction to decide whether the statements were SSI under the statute. So this is the MSPB doesn't, as I understand its ruling, it doesn't think that it has jurisdiction over this, that this has to be done in the Court of Appeals. And that's consistent with our view of the statute.
Do we have that opinion that you're talking about, the MSPB opinion?
No, I can get it for you, Your Honor.
That would be helpful.
If the court would like, I'll submit it after.
Just It says a person disclosing a substantial interest, et cetera, in the order may apply for review by filing a petition here. So the MSPB reads that as the exclusive avenue of review.
I believe that's the case, Your Honor, yes.
Yeah. It's only the firing that gives Mr. Laxon standing. Is that correct? I mean, that's his substantial
interest. To bring it here.
Well, standing to seek relief anywhere.
To be aggrieved.
To be aggrieved, right.
Under 46.110.
Yeah.
I had not thought about that. I think that's probably correct.
It's very puzzling. I mean, do you have any idea why this structure was set up?
No, I don't. But I think, the function of the structure is such that it allows somebody who is charged with a violation of the regulations to challenge that determination. I mean, that's the function of it. So it does allow these people to get a judicial determination.
Are most of the orders that are issued under this provision, aren't they orders saying such and such is SSI and unrelated to a particular disclosure, or are they actually orders relating to specific disclosure?
My understanding is there are not a lot of orders that have been issued under this provision. That's my understanding.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, sorry.
I'd like to say something. If the court is finished with discussing jurisdiction, I'd like to move on to the hearsay issue. What the agency did is it went to the specific people with knowledge of this. They weren't outside people. They were employees of TSA who have specific knowledge of the accuracy of the statements that Mr. Laxon made. And they confirmed the accuracy of the statements. It is true they did not submit affidavits to that effect, but they did confirm it. Because there's deferential review here and cases like this are inevitably going to have very small records, that should be sufficient. I'm sorry?
Would it have made the record any longer if the people who knew actually did affidavits, right?
If they did affidavits, it would be slightly larger than it is right now. Yes, Your Honor. that's certainly true.
Why? But wouldn't it replace the affidavit that has the hearsay?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
Wouldn't the affidavit from the people who knew replace the affidavit with the hearsay?
It would.
For no net gain in volume for the record.
Yeah, it would.
Not that economy of paper is a big feature.
Right. It would replace that if there were such thing, and there obviously is not in this case. But our position is that it's adequate given the situation, given the type of order we're dealing with here, given the deference that the court we believe should show to TSA in determining SSI issues. We think that this is adequate, and also under the case law that says that hearsay is permissible in agency adjudications.
There's nothing in the record indicating any difficulty in having the people who actually knew do affidavits, right?
The record does not say that it would be impossible to get an affidavit. That's correct.
Or even difficult in any way.
It does not say difficult either.
Is it a test case to see how how far TSA can go?
Right. One thing I'd like to point out in the regulation is I think that Mr. Berger seems to be reading the introductory language of B8 differently from what it seems to say on the face of it. He seems to say, and maybe I shouldn't put words in his mouth, he seems to say that that something has to be applied directly by the federal government, and that something is the specific details, so that we would have to show that the numbers that are disclosed in these posts were specifically applied. But in fact, if you read the introductory language, what has to be applied is the security measures more generally. That follows linguistically. It follows basically right before the directly applied.
Are you taking the position that specific numbers that are completely false RSSI?
Our position is
that requires a yes or no answer to begin with.
The answer is not as a general matter. No,
it's not quite a yes or no answer.
Well, I'm sorry. The answer is no, but I need a qualification.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay, I think the way the accuracy issue has to be divided is you start with things that are perfectly accurate. Those are obviously SSI if they fall within the category. Things that are substantially accurate are also SSI because they may easily convey some information, even apart from their technical accuracy, that could be detrimental to the security of transportation. Now, that's always the controlling issue. When they are not accurate, the question is, if even though they're not accurate, do they still convey that kind of information? And if they do, an inaccurate
And those are the only two categories that you regard as SSI, then. That is, accurate or close enough to cause a concern. Is that fair to put it that way?
I would expand the second one a little bit from that. And I would say that information that is inaccurate and yet discloses something that the agency wanted to be protected under SSI.
Well, that's self-defining. That doesn't seem
right. So can't be a little flash on it.
You can't say it's something that you want to protect because
then you'll always win. That can't be right. Let me try to give an example of this.
And since
we're in open court, let me give a hypothetical field office on the planet Mars, okay? Somebody discloses that the field office on the planet Mars has an attrition rate of X percent, and X is very low, okay? The actual attrition rate and people who are not being replaced is somewhat less unfavorable to the staffing level is very low. I should probably not talk about attrition. Let's just talk about staffing levels. Staffing level is extremely low. In fact, it's low, but not nearly that low. For example, hypothetically, 20% versus 70%. Now, that I think anybody who looked at those hypothetical figures would say the disclosure is inaccurate because it's way off, and yet the disclosure in that case does convey that there is an understaffing at this hypothetical field office on planet Mars, and that information is potentially detrimental to the security of transportation because people could judge from that because they're understaffed, they may have trouble deploying the number of federal air marshals.
Let me ask you this question. Imagine that the staffing is 100%. It's completely staffed, fully staffed. Let's put it another way. Imagine that there is an air marshal on a plane from Washington, D.C. to New York. There is one. And an air marshal announces on his blog, there is no air marshal today on a flight from Washington, D.C. to New York. Is that statement SSI?
I think so, Your Honor, even though it's inaccurate.
Well, I don't see how it's SSI. It's false, completely false. It may be the person could be fired for something else, but it's not a statement of actual information. What if he just announced, please attack this airplane today? That wouldn't be SSI. That would just be another problem.
Well, I think that one, yes, would be a very serious problem.
Yes, but not an SSI problem, not one that we would have before us.
I think that's right. I think the first example is a lot closer to what
Well, but if under that idea, you're basically saying anything that says an airport is not adequately protected, even if it is adequately protected, is SSI.
I thought you were trying to suggest that the 70% indicated a tempting degree of inadequacy.
That's right. That was my example.
It might be even stronger if you use 20-40, right? I mean,
okay.
20 seems really inaccurate vis-a-vis 40.
20-40 would be
like an invitation.
Yeah, 20-40 would be substantially correct. I was trying to give an example where it was obviously inaccurate.
Well, I thought 20-40 would be substantially incorrect.
Oh, okay. Well, then we'll use that example. That's easier for me to defend.
Now, the second question I have here is anything you're saying here actually TSA's view? Because it's not reflected in the TSA documents we have. To the contrary, at A13, Mr. Metzer says, it has been the position of the SSI branch that information known to be false is not SSI, except where the information is close enough to the real number to be detrimental. Now, what you're saying here really doesn't sound anywhere near like what Mr. Metzer says.
Well, he's focusing on the correct question, which is whether it is detrimental.
It says close enough to the real number. Now, let me give you the example again.
Okay.
In fact, there are 100 air marshals on the flight, and he says on his blog there are zero. Now, is that statement close enough to the real number to be detrimental?
I'm sorry for giving you an answer that's not going to be very satisfactory, but they would have to make that judgment. And in a case like that, I'll give you an example where it's obviously not SSI. Get back to staffing levels. The hypothetical field office is about to hire 2 million new federal air marshals. Well, anybody looking at that knows that's obviously false. Nobody in his right mind would say that could be detrimental to security. Now, I think that's pretty close to your example of 100 air marshals and nobody on there. But I think that would be a determination of whether the disclosure of that information could be detrimental to transportation.
Well, let me just again to focus the question. Is there any indication in the materials before us that the theory you are propounding is the one upon which the TSA made the decision in this case?
No, the decision in this case is narrow. I think as the court suggested when Mr. Berger was up here. The
question is, was this accurate or close enough to accurate?
That's right.
That's the question.
That's the way it was decided. I think that's the simplest way for the court to decide the case also.
Well, under Chenery, it's the only way we could decide.
Okay, but I was just trying to explain what the agency's thinking was. Mr. Metzler, by the way, is not the highest policymaking official on this issue.
But the highest policymaking official on this issue has not stated an opinion on this question.
No, that official is the one who signed the order.
But did not say.
No, that's correct.
The court
need not reach any of these issues, any of those broader issues.
All right, so I have one more question.
Yes.
Specification 5, post 3261. Where in the record is the evidence that that is true or close enough to true?
Let me make sure.
There are four specifications that are at issue here. This one happens to be called Specification 5 because one of the other specifications, number 2, was dropped out.
Right. That one, yeah. The only thing is that this is on page A17 of the record. It's in the list of statements by Mr. Laxon that most clearly released SSI, and that's the...
Right, so that's a statement by Mr. Metzler. Now, Mr. Metzler explains where he gets the information for the other ones, namely from Mr. Bolton's statement, right?
Right.
From Bolton's statement and from, is it also Bowers maybe, or just from Bolton's? From Bolton. Bolton actually doesn't address this at all, correct?
I believe not, that's correct.
So, Mr. Metzler says in the second line, the finding of SSI is based upon the SSI regulation and relies upon ASAC Bolton's memorandum to identify the information which is approximately accurate, right?
Right.
Those are the only sources he gives. And then he lists something that Mr. Bolton has not identified at all. So I have to say my own reading of this is Mr. Metzler is saying, based on the guidelines, this specification is specific enough that it would be SSI if it were accurate. But we don't have anything at all to suggest Mr. Metzler knows that one is accurate. Is that fair?
He does not spell out what he based his conclusion that it was accurate.
I'll ask for your inference. What would you even speculate that he would? How would he know about that? He's a law guy, right?
I beg your pardon?
He is a law guy, Mr. He's not a fact guy. He gets his facts from other people, and then he applies the regulations to them, correct?
I believe so, Your Honor.
So I understand your argument about Bolton. I understand your argument about Bauer. And I understand your argument about Bolton providing information to Metzer Metzler or Metzler? I'm sorry.
Metzler.
Metzler, and then Metzler applying the regulations to that. But this one seems to be a whole. That is, I can understand Metzler saying that this is sort of specific enough, although I suppose there would be a dispute about that. But there's no evidence anywhere that I see in the record to suggest either that Metzler even thinks he has personal knowledge or hearsay knowledge or anything of this one. And nobody else has given him that.
He does not identify his source. That is correct, Your Honor. So
wouldn't you agree that there is not substantial evidence on this one?
Well, if he says that he thinks it's true, I think that's probably enough.
Why? I mean, what if you said you thought it was true? We wouldn't think that was enough, not because we don't like you,
because
you have no knowledge.
That's right, except for the fact that, I mean, you're assuming that I said this as part of TSA, and I said,
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Well, if I had no knowledge, that's right. But
do we have any reason to think Metzler has any knowledge? He says where his knowledge comes from. He says he relies upon ASAC, Bolton's.
That's right, for those three statements, right. But for the fourth statement,
He doesn't say.
So
let's put it another way. There's no way for us to judge the reliability of his conclusion on this document, on that issue, correct?
I mean, you can judge it based on the fact that he said that the TSA order confirms it.
The TSA order is based, the TSA order specifically says it's based on their experts reviewing the statements, and it doesn't reflect any expert reviewing that statement.
No, I guess we have to assume that he spoke to people, and we do know that he spoke to people at various points in the investigation, but he doesn't identify who they are. That's correct, Your Honor.
No, but he doesn't even seem to.
Did he claim to have?
I have the same question.
Consulted people on that point?
He does not spell that out, no, Your Honor.
No, but he doesn't say it.
He does say with respect to the other ones, that's correct.
Right. So there's nothing?
There's nothing, yes. That's right.
It's not a question of spelling out in detail. It's a question of there being a gap.
That's correct.
Right. Okay.
Yes. If the court has no further questions, we'd ask the court to uphold the order under deferential review. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Does Schreier have any remaining time? All right. We'll give you a complete minute.
All I'll point out is that the record is inadequate for your review, and that the only predicate to support the accuracy or the close approximation to accuracy of this information is simply the assertions themselves. It is a bootstrap argument on the part of the agency. Mr. Jeffries, Mr. Bauer, simply say it is accurate. We don't even have the expansive interviews like the contractor in Honeywell. We only have their assertion. It is nothing but a tautology, and it's self-serving. And we don't believe that this record establishes substantial evidence to support this order.
You speak of interviews, which makes it sound very formal. But I guess looking at the part of the opinion that I'm looking at now, I don't see any reference to that formality. I mean, the contractor spoke to Andrews and Quinones and presumably wrote something down, and then someone else looking at that.
Understood, but at least there is some evidence of an effort to corroborate his opinion. What if the contractor merely said, this is wrong because it's wrong, and that's all he says, and that's all the record shows? I don't believe that as an expert that's adequate enough for this panel to review. Every expert has to rationalize his or her decision, and we have no rationalization here whatsoever. So thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under consideration. Thank you.